The Secret Adversary, Agatha Christie. Chapter 2. Mr. Whittington's Offer. Tuppence turned sharply, but the words, hovering on the tip of her tongue, remained unspoken, for the man's appearance and manner did not bear out her first and most natural assumption. She hesitated. As if he read her thoughts, the man said quickly, "I can assure you I mean no disrespect." Tuppence believed him. Although she disliked and distrusted him instinctively, she was inclined to acquit him of the particular motive which she had at first attributed to him. She looked him up and down. He was a big man, clean-shaven, with a heavy jowl. His eyes were small and cunning, and shifted their glance under her direct gaze. "Well, what is it?" she asked. The man smiled. "I happened to overhear part of your conversation with the young gentleman in Lyons." "Well, what of it?" "Nothing, except that I think I may be of some use to you." Another inference forced itself into Tuppence's mind. "You followed me here." "I took that liberty." "And in what way do you think you could be of use to me?" The man took a card from his pocket and handed it to her with a bow. Tuppence took it and scrutinized it carefully. It bore the inscription, "Mr. Edward Whittington." Below the name were the words, "Estonia Glassware Company," and the address of a city office. Mr. Whittington spoke again. "If you will call upon me tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock, I'll lay the details of my proposition before you." "At 11 o'clock," said Tuppence doubtfully. "At 11 o'clock. Tuppence made up her mind. "Very well, I'll be there." "Thank you, and good evening." He raised his hat with a flourish and walked away. Tuppence remained for some minutes gazing after him. Then she gave a curious movement of her shoulders, rather as a terrier shakes himself. "The adventures have begun," she murmured to herself. "What does he want me to do, I wonder? There's something about you, Mr. Whittington, that I don't like at all. But on the other hand, I'm not the least bit afraid of you. And as I've said before, and shall doubtless say again, little Tuppence can look after herself, thank you." And with a short, sharp nod of her head, she walked briskly onward. As a result of further meditations, however, she turned aside from the direct route and entered a post office. There she pondered for some moments, a telegraph form in her hand. The thought of a possible 5 shillings spent unnecessarily spurred her to action, and she decided to risk the waste of 9 pence. Disdaining the spiky pen and thick black treacle which a beneficent government had provided, Tuppence drew out Tommy's pencil, which she had retained, and wrote rapidly, "Don't put in advertisement. We'll explain tomorrow." She addressed it to Tommy at his club, from which in 1 short month he would have to resign, unless a kindly fortune permitted him to renew his subscription. "It may catch him," she murmured. "Anyway, it's worth a try." After handing it over the counter, she set out briskly for home, stopping at a baker's to buy 3 pennyworth of new buns. Later, in her tiny cubicle at the top of the house, she munched buns and reflected on the future. What was the Estonia Glassware Company, and what earthly need could it have for her services? A pleasurable thrill of excitement made Tuppence tingle. At any rate, the country vicarage had retreated into the background again. The morrow held possibilities. It was a long time before Tuppence went to sleep that night, and when at length she did, she dreamed that Mr. Whittington had set her up to washing up a pile of Estonia glassware, which bore an unaccountable resemblance to hospital plates. It wanted some 5 minutes to 11 when Tuppence reached the block of buildings in which the offices of the Estonia Glassware Company were situated. To arrive before the time would look overeager, so Tuppence decided to walk to the end of the street and back again. She did so. On the stroke of 11, she plunged into the recesses of the building. The Estonia Glasswork Company was on the top floor. There was a lift, but Tuppence chose to walk up. Slightly out of breath, she came to a halt outside the ground glass door with the legend painted across it, Estonia Glassware Company. Tuppence knocked. In response to a voice from within, she turned the handle and walked into a small, rather dirty, outer office. A middle-aged clerk got down from a high stool at a desk near the window and came towards her, inquiringly. "I have an appointment with Mr. Whittington," said Tuppence. "Will you come this way, please?" He crossed to a partition door with private on it, knocked, then opened the door and stood aside to let her pass in. Mr. Whittington was seated behind a large desk covered with papers. Tuppence felt her previous judgment confirmed. There was something wrong about Mr. Whittington. The combination of his sleek prosperity and his shifty eye was not attractive. He looked up and nodded. "So, you've turned up all right. That's good. Sit down, will you?" Tuppence sat down on the chair facing him. She looked particularly small and demure this morning. She sat there meekly, with downcast eyes, while Mr. Whittington sorted and rustled among his papers. Finally, he pushed them away and leaned over his desk. "Now, my dear young lady, let us come to business." His large face broadened into a smile. "You want work. Well, I have work to offer you. What should you say now to £100 down and all expenses paid?" Mr. Whittington leaned back in his chair and thrust his thumbs into the armholes of his waistcoat. Tuppence eyed him warily. "And the nature of the work?" she demanded. "Nominal, purely nominal. A pleasant trip, that's all." "Where to?" Mr. Whittington smiled again. "Paris." "Oh," said Tuppence thoughtfully. To herself, she said, "Of course, if Father heard that, he'd have a fit. But somehow I don't see Mr. Whittington in the role of the gay deceiver." "Yes," continued Whittington. "What could be more delightful? To put the clock back a few years, a very few, I'm sure, and re-enter one of those charming pensionnat de jeune fille with which Paris abounds." Tuppence interrupted him. "A pensionnat?" "Exactly. Madame Colombier's in the Avenue de Neuilly." Tuppence knew the name well. Nothing could have been more select. She had had several American friends there. She was more than ever puzzled. "You want me to go to Madame Colombier's? For how long?" "That depends. Possibly 3 months." "And that's all? There are no other conditions?" "None whatever. You would, of course, go in the character of my ward, and you would hold no communication with your friends. I should have to request absolute secrecy for the time being. By the way, you are English, aren't you?"
"Yes."
"Yet you speak with a slight American accent." "My great pal in hospital was a little American girl. I dare say I picked it up from her. I can soon get out of it again." "On the contrary, it might be simpler for you to pass as an American. Details about your past life in England might be more difficult to sustain." "Yes, I think it would be decidedly better." "Then, one moment, Mr. Whittington. You seem to be taking my consent for granted." Whittington looked surprised. "Surely you're not thinking of refusing. I can assure you that Madame Colombier's is a most high-class and orthodox establishment, and the terms are most liberal." "Exactly," said Tuppence. "That's just it. The terms are almost too liberal, Mr. Whittington. I can't see any way in which I can be worth that amount of money to you."
"No," said Whittington softly.
"Well, I'll tell you. I could doubtless obtain someone else for very much less. What I'm willing to pay for is a young lady with sufficient intelligence and presence of mind to sustain her part well, and also one who will have sufficient discretion not to ask too many questions." Tuppence felt a smile.
She felt that Whittington had scored. There's another thing. So far, there's been no mention of Mr. Beresford. Where does he come in?
Mr. Beresford?
My partner, said Tuppence with dignity. You saw us together yesterday.
Ah, yes. But I'm afraid we shan't require his services.
Then it's off, Tuppence rose. It's both or neither.
Sorry, but that's how it is. Good morning, Mr. Whittington.
Wait a minute. Let us see if something can't be managed. Sit down again, Miss...
He paused interrogatively.
Tuppence's conscience gave her a passing twinge as she remembered the Archdeacon. She seized hurriedly on the first name that came into her head.
Jane Finn, she said hastily, and then paused, open-mouthed, at the effect of those two simple words. All the geniality had faded out of Whittington's face. It was purple with rage, and the veins stood out on the forehead, and behind it all there lurked a sort of incredulous dismay. He leaned forward and hissed savagely.
"So that's your little game, is it?"
Tuppence, though utterly taken aback, nevertheless kept her head. She had not the faintest comprehension of his meaning, but she was naturally quick-witted, and felt it imperative to keep her end up, as she phrased it. Whittington went on.
"Been playing with me, have you, all the time, like a cat and mouse? Knew all the time what I wanted you for, but kept up the comedy. Is that it, eh?"
He was cooling down. The red color was ebbing out of his face. He eyed her keenly.
"Who's been blabbing? Rita?"
Tuppence shook her head. She was doubtful as to how long she could sustain this illusion, but she realized the importance of not dragging an unknown Rita into it.
"No," she replied with perfect truth. "Rita knows nothing about me."
His eyes still bored into her like gimlets.
"How much do you know?" he shot out.
"Very little indeed," answered Tuppence, and was pleased to note that Whittington's uneasiness was augmented instead of allayed. To have boasted that she knew a lot might have raised doubts in his mind.
"Anyway," snarled Whittington, "you knew enough to come in here and plump out that name."
"It might be my own name," Tuppence pointed out.
"It's likely, isn't it? Then there would be two girls with a name like that."
"Or I might just have hit upon it by chance," continued Tuppence, intoxicated with the success of truthfulness.
Mr. Whittington brought his fist down upon the desk with a bang. "Quit fooling. How much do you know? And how much do you want?"
The last five words took Tuppence's fancy mightily, especially after a meager breakfast and a supper of buns the night before. Her present part was of the adventures rather than the adventurous order, but she didn't deny its possibilities. She sat up and smiled with the air of one who has the situation thoroughly well in hand.
"My dear Mr. Whittington," she said, "let us, by all means, lay our cards upon the table. And pray, do not be so angry. You heard me say yesterday that I propose to live by my wits. It seems to me that I've now proved I have some wits to live by. I admit I have knowledge of a certain name, but perhaps my knowledge ends there."
"Yes, and perhaps it doesn't," snarled Whittington.
"You insist on misjudging me," said Tuppence, and sighed gently.
"As I said once before," said Whittington angrily, "quit fooling and come to the point. You can't play the innocent with me. You know a great deal more than you're willing to admit."
Tuppence paused a moment to admire her own ingenuity, and then said softly, "I shouldn't like to contradict you, Mr. Whittington. So we come to the usual question. How much?" Tuppence was in a dilemma. So far, she had fooled Whittington with complete success, but to mention a palpably impossible sum might awaken his suspicions. An idea flashed across her brain. "Suppose we say a little something down, and a fuller discussion of the matter later." Whittington gave her an ugly glance.
"Blackmail, eh?" Tuppence smiled sweetly. Oh, no. Shall we say payment of services in advance?
Whittington grunted.
You see, explained Tuppence still sweetly, I'm so very fond of money.
You're about the limit, that's what you are, growled Whittington, with a sort of unwilling admiration. You took me in, all right. Thought you were quite a meek little kid with just enough brains for my purpose.
Life, moralized Tuppence, is full of surprises.
All the same, continued Whittington, someone's been talking. You say it isn't Rita. Was it? Oh, come on in.
The clerk followed his discreet knock into the room and laid a paper at his master's elbow.
Telephone message just come for you, sir.
Whittington snatched it up and read it. A frown gathered on his brow.
That'll do, Brown. You can go.
The clerk withdrew, closing the door behind him. Whittington turned to Tuppence.
Come tomorrow at the same time. I'm busy now. Here's 50 to go on with.
He rapidly sorted out some notes and pushed them across the table to Tuppence, then stood up, obviously impatient for her to go. The girl counted the notes in a businesslike manner, secured them in her handbag, and rose.
Good morning, Mr. Whittington, she said politely. At least, au revoir, I should say.
Exactly, au revoir. Whittington looked almost genial again, a reversion that aroused in Tuppence a faint misgiving. Au revoir, my clever and charming young lady.
Tuppence sped lightly down the stairs. A wild elation possessed her. A neighboring clock showed the time to be 12:05.
Let's give Tommy a surprise, murmured Tuppence, and hailed a taxi.
The cab drew up outside the tube station. Tommy was just within the entrance. His eyes opened to their fullest extent as he hurried forward to assist Tuppence to alight. She smiled at him affectionately and remarked in a slightly affected voice, Pay the thing, will you, old bean? I've got nothing smaller than a 5-pound note.
Chapter 3. A Setback. The moment was not quite so triumphant as it ought to have been. To begin with, the resources of Tommy's pockets were somewhat limited. In the end, the fare was managed. The lady recollecting a plebeian 2-pence, and the driver, still holding the varied assortment of coins in his hand, was prevailed upon to move on, which he did after one last hoarse demand as to what the gentleman thought he was giving him.
I think you've given him too much, Tommy, said Tuppence innocently. I fancy he wants to give some of it back.
It was possibly this remark that induced the driver to move away.
Well, said Mr. Beresford, at length able to relieve his feelings, what the dickens did you want to take a taxi for?
I was afraid I might be late and keep you waiting, said Tuppence gently.
Afraid you might be late. Oh, Lord, I give it up, said Mr. Beresford.
And really and truly, continued Tuppence, opening her eyes very wide, I haven't got anything smaller than a 5-pound note.
You did that part of it very well, old bean, but all the same, the fellow wasn't taken in, not for a moment.
No, said Tuppence thoughtfully, he didn't believe it. That's the curious part about speaking the truth. No one does believe it. I found that out this morning. Now, let's go to lunch. How about the Savoy?
Tommy grinned.
How about the Ritz?
On second thoughts, I prefer the Piccadilly. It's nearer. We shan't have to take another taxi. Come along.
Is this a new brand of humor? Or is your brain really unhinged? Inquired Tommy.
Your last supposition is the correct one. I have come into money, and the shock has been too much for me. For that particular form of mental trouble, an eminent physician recommends unlimited hors d'oeuvre, lobster a l'Americaine, chicken Newburgh, and peach Melba. Let's go and get 'em.
Tuppence, old girl, what has really come over you?
Oh, unbelieving one. Tuppence wrenched open her bag. Look here, and here, and here. "Great Jehoshaphat! My dear girl, don't wave fishers aloft like that. They're not fishers. They're 5 times better than fishers, and this one's 10 times better." Tommy groaned. "I must have been drinking unawares. Am I dreaming, Tuppence? Or do I really behold a large quantity of 5-pound notes being waved about in a dangerous fashion?" "Even so, O king. Now, will you come and have lunch?" "I'll come anywhere. But what have you been doing? Holding up a bank?" "All in good time. What an awful place Piccadilly Circus is. There's a huge bus bearing down on us. It would be too terrible if they killed the 5-pound notes." "Grill room?" inquired Tommy, as they reached the opposite pavement in safety. "The other's more expensive," demurred Tuppence. "That's mere wicked, wanton extravagance. Come on below." "Are you sure I can get all the things I want here?" "That extremely unwholesome menu you were outlining just now?" "Of course you can. Or as much as is good for you, anyway." "And now tell me," said Tommy. Unable to restrain his pent-up curiosity any longer, as they sat in state, surrounded by the many hors d'oeuvre of Tuppence's dreams, Miss Cowley told him. "And the curious part of it is," she ended, "that I really did invent the name of Jane Finn. I didn't want to give him my own because of poor father, in case I should get mixed up in anything shady." "Perhaps that's so," said Tommy slowly. "But you didn't invent it."
"What?"
"No, I told it to you. Don't you remember? I said yesterday I'd overheard 2 people talking about a female called Jane Finn. That's what brought the name into your mind so pat."
"So you did. I remember now. How extraordinary."
Tuppence tailed off into silence. Suddenly, she aroused herself. "Tommy!"
"Yes?"
"What were they like, the 2 men you passed?" Tommy frowned in an effort at remembrance. "One was a big, fat sort of chap, clean-shaven, I think, and dark."
"That's him!" cried Tuppence, in an ungrammatical squeal. "That's Whittington! What was the other man like?"
"I can't remember. I didn't notice him particularly. It was really the outlandish name that caught my attention." "And people say that coincidences don't happen." Tuppence tackled her peach Melba happily. But Tommy had become serious.
"Look here, Tuppence, old girl. What is this going to lead to?"
"More money," replied his companion.
"I know that. You've only got one idea in your head. What I mean is, what about the next step? How are you going to keep the game up?"
"Oh," Tuppence laid down her spoon. "You're right, Tommy. It is a bit of a poser. After all, you know you can't bluff him forever. You're sure to slip up sooner or later. And anyway, I'm not at all sure that it isn't actionable. Blackmail, you know."
"Nonsense. Blackmail is saying you'll tell unless you're given money. Now, there's nothing I could tell because I don't really know anything."
"Hmm," said Tommy doubtfully. "Well, anyway, what are we going to do? Whittington was in a hurry to get rid of you this morning, but next time he'll want to know something more before he parts with his money. He'll want to know how much you know and where you got your information from and a lot of other things that you can't cope with. What are you going to do about it?"
Tuppence frowned severely. "We must think. Order some Turkish coffee, Tommy. Stimulating to the brain."
"Oh, dear, what a lot I've eaten."
"You have made rather a hog of yourself."
"So have I, for that matter, but I flatter myself that my choice of dishes was more judicious than yours. 2 coffees, this was to the waiter, 1 Turkish, 1 French. Tuppence sipped her coffee with a deeply reflective air and snubbed Tommy when he spoke to her.
"Be quiet, I'm thinking."
"Shades of Pelmanism," said Tommy, and relapsed into silence.
"There," said Tuppence at last, "I've got a plan. Obviously,
What we've got to do is to find out more about it all. Tommy applauded.
Don't jeer. We can only find out through Whittington.
We must discover where he lives, what he does.
Sleuth him, in fact.
Now, I can't do it because he knows me. But he only saw you for a minute or two in Lyons. He's not likely to recognize you. After all, one young man is much like another.
I repudiate that mark utterly.
I'm sure my pleasing features and distinguished appearance would single me out from any crowd.
My plan is this, Tuppence went on calmly. I'll go alone tomorrow. I'll put him off again like I did today. It doesn't matter if I don't get any more money at once. £50 ought to last us a few days, or even longer. You'll hang about outside. When I come out, I shan't speak to you in case he's watching. But I'll take up my stand somewhere near, and when he comes out of the building, I'll drop a handkerchief or something, and off you go.
Off I go where?
Follow him, of course, silly. What do you think of the idea?
Sort of thing one reads about in books. I somehow feel that in real life, one will feel a bit of an ass standing in the street for hours with nothing to do. People will wonder what I'm up to.
Not in the city. Everyone's in such a hurry. Probably no one will even notice you at all.
That's the second time you've made that sort of remark.
Never mind, I forgive you. Anyway, it will be rather a lark. What are you doing this afternoon?
Well, said Tuppence meditatively, I had thought of hats, or perhaps silk stockings, or perhaps...
Hold hard, admonished Tommy. There's a limit to £50.
But let's do dinner and a show tonight, at all events.
Rather.
The day passed pleasantly. The evening even more so. Two of the £5 notes were now irretrievably dead. They met by arrangement the following morning and proceeded citywards. Tommy remained on the opposite side of the road, while Tuppence plunged into the building. Tommy strolled slowly down to the end of the street, then back again. Just as he came abreast of the building, Tuppence darted across the road.
Tommy!
Yes, what's up?
The place is shut. I can't make anyone hear.
That's odd.
Isn't it? Come up with me and let's try again.
Tommy followed her. As they passed the third floor landing, a young clerk came out of an office. He hesitated a moment, then addressed himself to Tuppence.
Were you wanting the Estonia glassware?
Yes, please.
It's closed down since yesterday afternoon. Company being wound up, they say. Not that I've ever heard of it myself, but anyway, the office is to let.
Thank you, faltered Tuppence. I suppose you don't know Mr. Whittington's address.
Afraid I don't. They left rather suddenly.
Thank you very much, said Tommy. Come on, Tuppence.
They descended to the street again, where they gazed at one another blankly.
That's Tornet, said Tommy at length.
And I never suspected it, wailed Tuppence.
Cheer up, old thing, it can't be helped.
Can't it, though? Tuppence's little chin shot out defiantly.
Do you think this is the end?
If so, you're wrong. It's just the beginning.
The beginning of what?
Of our adventure.
Tommy, don't you see? If they're scared enough to run away like this, it shows that there must be a lot in this Jane Finn business.
Well, we'll get to the bottom of it. We'll run them down. We'll be sleuths in earnest.
Yes, but there's no one left to sleuth.
No, that's why we'll have to start all over again. Lend me that bit of pencil.
Thanks.
Wait a minute. Don't interrupt.
There.
Tuppence handed back the pencil and surveyed the piece of paper on which she had written with a satisfied eye,
What's that?
Advertisement.
You're not going to put that thing in after all.
No, it's a different one.
She handed him the slip of paper.
Tommy read the words on it aloud.
Wanted. Any information respecting Jane Finn. Apply YA.